listening to a podcast by the United Nations Research Institute for Social Development.
This is a recording of a seminar given by Devaki Jain, co-editor of the book Harvesting Feminist Knowledge for Public Policy, Rebuilding Progress, as well as Naoko Otobi of the ILO and Mariama Williams of the South Center, with introductory remarks from UNRWA's director Sarah Cook at the United Nations office in Geneva on June 25th, 2012.
The seminar today is really talking about research that went into this exciting book. There are some copies out there, Harvesting Feminist Knowledge for Public Policy. And I think, you know, I've just come back straight off the plane from Rio. And if we look at the outcome document, gender is there very prominently. Gender equity, gender equality, women's empowerment. It's there, but I think not strategically. And I think the real challenge for us, we've got decades now of excellent research. We've got conceptual, theoretical, practical, empirical research on gender issues, on women and development, things that can challenge the paradigms, the development thinking. And yet, we're not always being strategic in how we use the knowledge that we have. And I think one of the big challenges for us is really to, as they say in the title of this book, to harvest that knowledge for public policy to make change. And I think this book is quite an important contribution to this thinking. It was co-edited by Devaki Jain and Diane Elson and includes many leading feminist scholars, economists, political scientists, anthropologists, people from different disciplines and different approaches. And let me just quote from the opening remarks of the book. They say, the authors or editors say, it is not enough to call for the participation of women in existing patterns of market-based production or for the empowerment of women within existing paradigms of development or for gender mainstreaming within existing configurations of institutional power. It is the forms of production, the paradigms, and the institutions themselves that need questioning and transforming, both through changes in the ideas that generate economic policies and through social mobilization. And I think that really summarizes that what we're trying to do with the knowledge now is contribute to the need for much more transformative change in the development path that we've been pursuing, which has particularly been part of the discourse in the post-crisis or ongoing crisis period, but where we're not really yet managing to make a huge amount of headway. But I think this seminar is an opportunity to explore some of these challenges and to think about how we take our knowledge, the policy discourse, the frameworks, the values forward in a way in which we can start to reframe and reshape discussions towards not just greater gender equity, that's obviously important, but more generally towards greater social inclusion along all the dimensions of inequalities that we're experiencing at this point. So I would like to turn and briefly introduce all three speakers, and then we'll go through them in turn. The first speaker will be Devaki Jain, who has a very distinguished career as a leading feminist researcher. She has an MA in economics from Oxford University, has been a visiting fellow at a number of universities, including Harvard and the Institute of Development Studies at Sussex. She has numerous awards, including from UNDP and the Padma Bhushan Award. She's a founding member, and I think this is very important, of DAWN, which is an organization I'm not sure everybody is familiar with, Development Alternatives for Women in the New Era, and has been the director of the Institute of Social Studies Trust in India. And she's widely published on issues of gender. Our second speaker will be Naoko Otobi. And Naoko is currently the Gender and Employment Coordinator at the ILO, so here in Geneva, and again has very substantial expertise and experience in research, advisory, capacity building and management of development projects, particularly related to employment promotion and gender equity. And her research and publications include a number of developing and transition countries, and in particular focused on gender-differentiated impact of macroeconomic change on employment. Our third speaker is Mariama Williams from the South Centre. She's a senior fellow with the South Centre and again has an extensive publication and research and publication record on gender and trade issues. There are also some publications out there that you can look at. And more recently is working on gender and climate finance, climate change financing. And so her current research interests are the financial crisis and global economy and climate change financing. So I think we've got a wide range within this panel of different aspects, critical aspects, and the more transformative aspects engaging between employment, gender equality, and the macroeconomic and financial environment. So I look forward to a very stimulating set of presentations, and then of about 15 minutes each, and then we will open the floor to discussion. So why don't I invite Debbie to start. It's the red one.
Well, thank you so much, Sarah, and I would like to take this opportunity to thank all the three institutions and the people within them, Sarah and Christine, who worked very hard to get this thing done. And South Centre, not only Mariama, but also Anna. I don't know if Anna is here. And Martin Kaur for also hosting it. And of course, Marco Tobe, who is an author in the book, and also a friend, and the ILO for jointly convening this. Good morning, everybody. But I do miss Diane Elson, who is a co-editor, and we tried very hard to get her. I think it would have made a big difference if she could have been here. I want to thank these three institutions and the people within them which have put this thing together, because it gives me a unique opportunity to share some of my current ideas on a new agenda for the feminist movement. It's a very ambitious thing I'm saying, but I do want to provoke and get some feedback, as I argue that we are located in new situations and a new world reordering of economic energy, apart from the challenges to the old political hegemonies. So apart from the multiple crises that we talk about, I feel these are some of the platforms on which we are now resting, and therefore some of my points will be addressed to this. So taking off from the, just to be precise and to get in within 15 minutes, I'm going to read the few pages that I've written. Taking off from ideas and proposals in the book, I would place before you four arguments or propositions and look forward to your questioning them. One, the value of think tanks. Two, the ideas in the book. Three, my views on feminist advocacy. And four, some open-ended ideas for a follow-up. And as we have mentioned, Diane and myself, in the introduction of the book, this is the sixth stop in the Casablanca Group's journey of thinking and writing and trying it out on the ground and then coming back and thinking and writing. So we have some slides which gives the pictures of the women who participated. You can move those slides very fast. The initial aim of the Casablanca Dream Group was narrow, to influence, to actually redesign the UN's framework for what is called gender and development, moving it from gender equality to the influence of gendered analysis on macroeconomic policy directions. And you would be amused to hear that after 3 days of brainstorming in Casablanca, we wanted to remove the UNDP's gender framework, which is gender equality and MDG, and we replaced it by women, water, and wealth, arguing that wealth it captures inequality. And we also argued that this should be the headlines that replace gender equality and the MDG. And then we added also getting the fundamentals right, which is a criticism of the World Bank and finance ministers who keep saying, balance the budget, get the fundamentals right. So we were really attacking these existing formats. But why I mentioned that is, I think this experience, the process and outcomes, reveals or affirms the importance of think tanks, of process, of formation of groups who ponder over issues outside of systems, outside the UN, and bring some light or fires for consideration. This is different from networks, from associations. It is the brainstorming of like-minded, similar-track people or compatibles who can prepare think pieces for inputting into the formal space. I'll mention more about my recommendation of think tanks later. Now I come to the book. I'd like to quote or mention the way Professor Jayati Ghosh, who is well known in Geneva, described the book at the launch in Delhi. She said, the book is not about women. It is about how to redefine and reevaluate all the terms we use to assess progress. GDP, even achievement of MDG, assessment of gender equality, all that baggage. It was to replace this baggage by arguing for the incorporation of the knowledge that gendered analysis, the gendered experience, reveals into the knowledge pools, into economic reasoning basically, into valuation, and therefore into policy actions. So all the contributors argue that understanding and responses to gender inequality has to be situated within the context of other forms of inequality, and that efforts to promote gender equality should not be divorced from efforts to promote a more equal world for all. And I think Sarah has already quoted the para that I was going to read out to you as our basic ishti. I argue that this is an important game shift. In fact, I've called my paper Time for a Game Shift. Moving us away from what has become a universal mantra whenever I go to any UN meetings, that is the goal of gender equality as the main platform for feminist advocacy. But I want to suggest that gendered analysis, what I just said, of development policy or growth theory can provide the value, the ideas for a valuable change in direction and substance, which in fact would enable the goals of policy itself, apart from getting us gender equality. We see this call resonated in all the 14 essays, which are narratives of work and lived experience of feminists from about 10 countries. And I've got some slides just giving some of the quotes. If you don't mind, you could put them. To save time, we are not reading them out. Now I come to some of the key ideas in the book. One is that economic democracy has to go hand in hand with political democracy, and that the trickle-down theory of growth needs to be replaced by the bubbling-up theory of growth. And you will understand what we mean by economic democracy, because all these deals that are being signed by leaders in our countries with corporates and World Bank and so on, they're all not transparent. And therefore, we argue that every economic decision like that, and one of the reasons that we are deeply in a corruption situation in India today, is because these deals are not signed or open or participatory. So we argue that economic democracy is as fundamental as a pillar for political democracy. And secondly, about the trickle-down theory of growth, which is what is now here, you accumulate and then you give to help poor to get out of poverty, needs to be replaced by the bubbling-up theory of growth. We suggest shifting the theories of growth. In fact, we're shifting the engines of growth. The engine should not be capital-driven. We suggest that the process of poverty removal itself can be an engine of growth, leading to growth that bubbles up rather than trickles down. Rather than targeting the poor as beneficiaries with handouts, putting incomes in the hands of the poor through a policy that provides broad-based livelihoods, and that generates a new kind of demand which I'll describe to you. The details of a bubbling-up growth theory will of course vary from country to country, but in each case we suggest that the control of money and banking, the determination of public expenditure and taxation, the operation of markets, including international markets, the enjoyment of rights to resources and to work, and the reasoning on which economic policy is based would need to change. Some ideas of the kinds of changes that are necessary can be gained from many practices and concepts developed by women in their struggles for equality. And indeed, I want to call attention and bring to the room the Nobel laureate, Elinor Ostrom. I'm so sorry that she's not being celebrated by feminists all over the world, because her thesis, which won her the Nobel, and as the first economist to get it, woman economist to get it, actually provides proof for this proposition, namely that it is people-driven, community-driven decisions that are more efficient than state-driven. She had actually agreed to come to a discussion on the book, but then, as you know, she passed away just a couple of days before Rio, and she was looking forward to Rio. Now, the potential of such a growth model can be illustrated by some country examples. For example, in India, this idea of wage-led growth, putting incomes in the hands of every individual, man and woman, and supporting it with backward-forward linkages, that is, supply of raw materials and marketing, was proposed by Gandhi as a way for us to survive without the British. But as you know, that was marginalized. But in case anyone is interested in Gandhian economics, I'd be happy to answer those questions later. Another person who supports this bubbling-up theory of growth without using that language is Hazel Henderson. You must have seen her in all the networks. She and several other active advocates are also suggesting a growth from the bottom, as that precludes both the peaking of inequality, which as you know is huge now, as well as the need to find ways to distribute. So this is one area for our engagement which I'll talk about later. What I wish to say next can be understood only if you know where I come from. Otherwise it sounds outrageous in this milieu. I just want to mention to you that I'm here after 45 years of engagement with the women's movement, starting in 1975, research related to public policy in India, the statistical system, the five-year plan, dozens of forays into the UN spaces, attended all the UN World Conferences on Women, apart from working in several global commissions. Looks absolutely vulgar how much I have participated. But I also did a book called Women in the UN, a 60-year quest for equality as part of the UN intellectual history project. This experience makes me say what I want to say now, and that is that we feminists have ghettoed ourselves. Our knowledge of lived experience as well as research has not crossed the barriers. That's what Sarah was just referring to. We are locked or have locked ourselves into the women's tent. And this is the other controversial point I want to make on how we get out of it. In further analysis of this situation, I have come to the view that we have emphasized, despite all our denials, issues, ideas, demands arising out of our bodily difference, biologically and socially defined. Even in my view, even goals like gender equality basically continue the old game of catching up with men, revealing the discrimination, asking for justice. We ask for greater recognition of our difference, care work, unpaid work, drawing attention to our separated selves. What I am arguing for is that we need to engage with thought. We have to develop ideas out of our intellectual as well as our grassroots experience. Amartya Sen has a brilliant quote on this. He says, "Not to see us as patients, but to see us as agents of change." And you'll be happy to know that India, a working group of feminist economists which I put together, we've actually done that in the 12th plan. We've called it poor women growth agents and not beneficiaries of anti-poverty programs. It's really shifted the mindset of some of our male economists. So now I want to end with a few of the recommendations that I thought would help us to... just excuse me for a minute. I have time?
Yes.
I've summarized some proposals which I thought might be a fair way of ending this. I have three or four proposals. I'm just wondering where I put it. One is about think tanks. Sorry about that. I made several copies of this, which is why I lost my original. Okay, never mind. I'll summarize it. One is the value of think tanks. I'm proposing that we should have some think tanks, the way I said, out of the box, on some current issues. Like, for example, the current issue of BRICS, the South formation. We don't know what's happening inside it, and I feel people like Mariama Williams and the South Center can unpack the arrangements that BRICS is making to see what does it do for women workers who might lose jobs or gain jobs. We don't know what will happen. But there are these new configurations in the South where we haven't unpacked it to see what is the gendered analysis of these arrangements. So that is one thought I have. The other is, apparently there's going to be a Beijing plus 15 or something like that. And instead of it being left to the UN system to decide the framework against which the countries make their reports of achievements in Beijing or whatever, if there was a brainstorming by a group of intellectuals or activists come intellectuals, a think tank, which puts together a piece, a kind of thought piece, which says, this is how the women's movement and the feminist scholars and activists would like to see considered in 2015 by the world in relation to women. So these are some of the kinds of places where I thought think tank could be useful. And again, I'm repeating that these are informal get-togethers. Another way this could, if you want to recommend, would be to ask the UN to set up a commission, not the UN women, nor the UNDP gender team, nor all the women focal points in all the UN agencies, but a commission, a women's commission, which tries to look at, puts all these roads together to see what could be an advisory that comes out for all of us to consider, circulate it widely and then come to a meeting. Because to go back, this idea of the Casablanca dream started in 2000 at Beijing plus 5, when many of us, who I was much younger, said that, look, after Beijing, we are all going to sort of get going downslide in terms of women's rights. So at that time, we said we must think how to revive the women's movement to be more proactive and to do. And the last one, which I would really like all of you to look at carefully, is to say, should there be a think tank which fleshes out the bubbling up theory of growth. You see, these ideas like Keynes or Raoul Prabash, when they come with an idea, the whole world catches it. We all talk of Keynes in economics. We talk of Prabash in trade. We even talk of Marx in our ideological discourses. But we don't talk of a theory developed by women. We have theories in other departments, but not in economics. So this bubbling up theory of growth, which is broadly accepted as the way women would like to see growth happen from the bottom up, it has to be put into proper economic reasoning. It should be a theory which, if we write a book and publish it, it should say, my God, here is a new theory which we can grasp on. So I'm all for ideas being more powerful or equally powerful to action. And I think women, feminist movement has not done enough on generating brilliant ideas which we can negotiate with the other. And I want to end with a quotation from Karen Brown, who's a friend of all of us and a brilliant young economist. She said, use the tools of the enemy. You want to negotiate a new macroeconomic policy, you collect the data, you put it together just like the World Bank and others do it, and you put it across. You can't go there and say, we demand, we are sorry, you have not done right. So I thought I would mention that as our way forward. I thank you very much, Sarah.
I think we've got some big challenges out there to develop a bottom-up theory of growth, if that can be done. How would it be done? And whether it can be done using the tools of the enemy, or whether fundamentally there's a real contradiction there between the methodologies of the dominant paradigm, neoclassical economic paradigm, and what we're trying to propose here. I think that's an interesting methodological challenge. There's many other rich issues which I'm sure people will pick up in the discussion, but I'd like to turn immediately to Naoki to give her presentation.
Thank you very much, Sarah.
Is it working?
No? The red, okay.
Yeah, it's working. Yeah.
Thank you very much, Sarah, for the kind introduction. And I also would like to thank again the honor seat, also in South Center, for co-hosting this seminar so that we could have this dialogue to continue the collective thinking
right
along
here.
The line of the Casablanca movement, the feminist movement. And after Devaki's very provocative introductory but also very powerful speech, I do not know whether I could really justice to your calls, but my role here is to really share with you what I have written as more like a small think piece on the gender damage of the water work in a globalized economy. And as we all know, historically thinking, when the crisis hits in general, it is very often the women who bear the brunt. That's the reason why we really need to, this is really a critical time to focus on promoting women's status in the water work, so that we don't lose the gains, especially the women, the gains that we have made in the past. So this chapter I've written actually, because that was how it was asked initially, basically it's really to review the past progress in this respect and suggest the way forward. And I'll see whether I managed to answer some of the challenges, questions that Devaki has posed here today. And in terms of topics of destruction and discussion, I'll be talking about gender equality in the water work, then briefly presenting the gender dimensions of recent employment trends, highlighting the impact of recent crisis. Then I will also introduce this concept of multiple dimensional poverty with the gender dimensions. And we'll also talk about the economic policies, employment, and poverty, the linkages, especially the gender dimensions. And since, of course, coming from the International Labour Organization, I would still present those instruments for poverty alleviation and advancing gender equality, and end with some thoughts and as conclusions. So basically, gender equality is really at the heart of the decent work agenda. In the ILO, we're trying to promote what we call decent work, which is more conceptually defined as work undertaken in freedom, equity, security, and human dignity. And this is really cross-cutting priority in our work. And without gender equality, although Devaki said, well, we are not talking about gender equality, but still I'm talking about gender equality here, we say no decent work could be achieved, because when certain groups of the, well, in fact, a large majority, half of the population is discriminated against in terms of opportunities, that is really not the ideal scenario in terms of in the achievement of this work. And in that respect, we do have two key international labor standards, or we call international labor standards. One is 100 on equal remuneration. The other one is 111, that deals with discrimination in employment and occupation. And of course, talking in the panel here, I would certainly, I'll be amiss if I didn't also mention UN CEDAW also prohibits all forms of discrimination, in particular against women, which is semi-almost universally ratified by so many countries. But just as a footnote, our key convention in terms of forbidding discrimination in employment, especially in occupation, we have other grounds in addition to what we call gender or sex. In other words, we have race, color, religion, political opinion, national extraction, and social origin as additional grounds that are also covered under this international labor standard. But we also know that women face double or triple discrimination when you are in an ethnic minority, or maybe a migrant, or younger or older, you know. Other characteristics of women tend to compound the discrimination that a poor, especially women, faces. And looking at where women are in the world of work, you know, the share of women in the global workforce, it has been more or less at 40%. It hasn't really drastically changed over the last 10 years or so. Although there have been some slow but steady, narrowing gender gaps and progress, I should say, women's participation in wage employment has slowly increased over the last 20 years. But as we all know, the wage gap still persists. In different countries, the wage gap could vary from 10% to 30%. And men, unfortunately, even in a similar occupation, they earn more. And this is also because women tend to be concentrated in certain occupations, and the gender segregation still persists in the labor market in many countries. And women also tend to be more and underemployed than men on average, particularly in developing countries or developing regions. And when it comes to youth, both men and young women and men are equally affected by higher unemployment as compared to the adults, as we had a big discussion during the last June, this month, the International Labour Conference, the discussion on youth employment challenges, because they are typically highly, the high unemployment youth is a major problem, and we also need to be quite aware of the gender dimension thereof as well. There are times that the men are more unemployed than women, but in other cases, women still can be more highly unemployed as compared to men. And women are also more concentrated in jobs with lower pay, security, and prestige. Women are also grossly underrepresented in executive positions. We also know that. And also, in terms of education, equal access to education, while progress has been made, especially in access to primary education for boys and girls, typically, on average, women tend to be less educated than men in many countries. And even in countries where women are better educated, this has not necessarily translated into better labor market outcomes. And this is also because women also continue to bear most of the double burden of productive and reproductive work, being the main provider of care, undertaking unpaid care work, as we say. And we also know it's become such a cliche, but women's access to productive assets, resources, and services are more limited compared to men. And this is because persistent social institutions that dictates the roles of women and women at home, in the community, in the world of work, are very slow to change. And as a consequence, women are overrepresented among the poor and more affected by these work deficits. And this chart just shows how the story of the developed countries in terms of labor market, in terms of impact of the crisis is that before the crisis, unemployment rate on average was higher for women. But after the 2008-09 crisis hit, unemployment rate in general not only has shot up quite fast for both, but more importantly, in fact, in industrialized economies, men's unemployment rate really has shot up. But if you look at the developing country situations, these are the regions where the gender gaps are quite substantial in terms of the rates. As you can see, women's unemployment rate, on average, all of them are much higher compared to men's. So what I wanted to say here, before the crisis hit, women's employment at the place of women in the labor market had always been difficult and disadvantaged as compared to men. So women had been always faced with a crisis before crisis in this respect. This similar, in that respect also here, this is a chart of the rate of vulnerable employment and employment of men and women respectively in different developing regions. Vulnerable employment is a combination of two employment statuses. One is on own account work, the other one is the contributing family work. And as you can see, in poorer regions, the rate is quite substantial. Not only substantial, but also if you look at the men and women's rates, women are much more affected. In women's employment, the share of the vulnerable employment is quite substantial, as you can see. And it's higher than men's. And in terms of the impact of 2008-09 global economic crisis on employment in developing regions, this has really been felt largely through the trade channels. This is because the jobs in export sectors, where typically there's a higher concentration of women's jobs, especially in labor-intensive production such as textile clothing sector. For instance, in Cambodia, they lost something like over 33,570 jobs between 2008 and 2010. In other words, these jobs are lost and never recovered in the sector because they export a lot to the U.S. And then of those working in this particular sector, the 90% of the workers are women. And we also need to remember, in many countries, women's re-entry to the labor market is more difficult than for men, just simply because their employment opportunities are less diversified in terms of sectors and occupations. And talking of the poverty and working poverty and gender, of 3 billion working population, estimated 455.8 million were in working poverty of living with less than $1.25 a day. That was 2011, according to ILO estimates. And furthermore, estimated 944.5 billion workers were below working poverty of $2 a day, almost 30%. And poverty has really a women's face. And then large majority of the world's poor are women. It's also because their employment typically is characterized by lower pay, poorer working conditions, and precarious. And they're often working in atypical work forms of employment as well. And in terms of working poverty level in selected developing regions, in East Asia in 2011, it was 7.8%. Southeast Asia was just over 11%, and South Asia was 35.9%, and in Sub-Saharan Africa was 38.1%. And then I will move on to the gender dimension of poverty here. As you can see, the poverty is multidimensional, and from the ILO's perspective, I would even add freedom and security in this respect. And gender dimensions cut across all these aspects of poverty, where women tend to have less access to all these aspects of the consumption, dignity, and so forth. We also know that there is a cost of gender inequality in development, because underutilization of women's human capital and human resources and capabilities certainly will lead to less development. In terms of where poor are working, we also know that most working poor are found in the urban informal rural economies, and much of women's work is agriculture is unpaid, and in some countries, feminization of agriculture is observed. And women are also a large majority in the informal economy in many countries, therefore their work typically is invisible, with low pay, with low productivity, and outside the protection and labor laws. And much of poor women's work, both paid and unpaid, remains unaccounted for. And women, especially in the informal economy, are unorganized, neither represented, nor do they have equal voice as men. This is what we call disembodied deficits. And in this respect, girls and young and old women are at higher risk of poverty. In terms of the background to persistent poverty, there are different multi-factors, as you see here. And as a result, many of the women and girls are ending up with the very vulnerable groups, such as migrant workers, domestic workers, and working as domestic workers in migration, or even trafficked into sex sector and so forth. So I would argue addressing gender dimension in poverty alleviation is really critical. I would also say laissez-faire approach to economic growth and employment creation will not automatically translate into poverty reduction, particularly of discriminated groups. We also have noted that after the period of market-driven economic policies, governments have bailed out the too big to fail banks. In other words, they have also narrowed the fiscal space themselves. And that's the reason why we feminists are also calling for alternative macroeconomic frameworks, or what we call just economy and more inclusive growth. And in this respect, getting macroeconomic framework right could potentially lead to a more enabling environment for gender justice and well-being of people. In terms of, I'm not so sure I would really have the time, but I'll just probably go through whatever. In terms of economic policies and employment poverty, promoting employment is really the most effective way of reducing income and material poverty, including for women, but quality of employment also matters. Proper growth, that means proper growth should really be with high employment content, but we also should pay specific attention to gender dimension in this respect. And past neoliberal macroeconomic policies implemented in poor developing countries have been much subject to criticism, especially by feminist economists in particular. And we also take note that the past decade of globalization period coincided with increasing income inequality, feminization of labor market, and a declining share of labor income as well. And in terms of linkages to exports, the exports could be, there could be a pro-cyclical impact on women's employment in general, and policies favoring exports could potentially have a positive impact on women's employment. But trade liberalization in general, involving import substitution, the net and gender impacts could vary depending on where men and women are, because there is a sex segregation of men and women in labor market. It is a monetary policy, frequently reducing inflation could have a negative impact on employment in general, but in particular for women. And in terms of fiscal policies, bigger government spending could potentially have more pro-employment impact. So in this respect, narrowing fiscal space is not also good news for women. In terms of public sector reforms, this could have differential impacts on men and women, depending on the share of women in the sector, but also how the right sizing is implemented. I think this is really quite pertinent in the European context, because they are likely to cut down on the health and education, for example, employment, where women could be more negatively affected. When men are more substantially affected by retrenchments, the impact on women can be indirect. In other words, they may try to increase hour of work, not only in unpaid care work, but also more importantly, during more income outside household, creating added workers' effect. We have also seen the trends of informalization of labor in many countries. This is related to persistent poverty in the world, and in particular, in times of crisis, this has been observed. And I think time up. Okay. I would just end with this particular slide on decent work then. So I would argue for integrated approach through a decent work agenda. In other words, we have the promotion of decent and productive employment, social protection, legal policy reforms, and organization building. And in terms of means of action, we have standard setting, technical cooperation, research advocacy, and this work agenda covers these. And it can be operationalized through the One UN system as we work with other UN organizations. Thank you.
Thank you, Nick, for having a very comprehensive discussion of the gendered employment issues, but also making the links, which I think are critical to the macroeconomic, fiscal, trade, and I think we can then add finance agenda, which may be coming next. So I'll turn to maybe Maria.
Or maybe not. Okay, so good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for coming, and thank you for your time and attention. I'd like to thank again, as with the fellow speakers, the ILO, UNRIS, especially Kristen, for all her real hard work. There's all the logistics around this, really appreciate it. And I'd like to thank Anna Bernardo from the South Center, who's also on my end been doing quite a lot of the coordination. And Martin Kaur and the South Center team that helped to facilitate at least one of the meetings of the Casablanca group before I came. This is really a great pleasure and a real extreme honor for me to be on this panel. Devaki Jain is a well-known and quite famous economist. But more importantly, she was one of the commissioner of the South Commission, which was the precursor to the South Center. So she was actually the founder, one of the many founders, including Mamoon Singh and others, of the South Center. And so it's really quite a pleasure to be here. It's also quite thrilling for me to be at the launch of this book, and I think I'd like to hold it up again, because I think it's really quite, apart from the fact that it's lovely looking, it's quite rich and filled with details. The arrival of this book is certainly opportune in light of the urgent global issues that must be contended with and which are having and will continue to have tremendous adverse impacts on the lives and the life chances of poor men and women, most especially those in developing countries. So this panel on multiple global crises and gender rethinking alternative path is occurring in the backdrop, of, as Sarah said, of the Rio 20 plus 20 meeting and the most recent G20 leader summit. But most importantly, from where we want to go from here, it's occurring in the shade of the post-Rio 20, which is where the activities will go, the dawning of the post-2015 MDG, and the launch of what within the UN system has been referred to as the post-2015 New Development Agenda. And as Devaki pointed out, there's also talk not just about Beijing 15, but a fifth World Conference on Women. So this is the right moment, the right time for harvesting feminist knowledge. So I want to make three distinct strand of intervention, which I know I will have to hurry through and also conjugate quite a lot. The first is I really feel that I need to make a short reflection on the book, though that's not my remit. But as a non-member of the collective that produced the book, I feel that it's only natural that I give some sort of vested observer brief reflection on some of the key highlights that struck me in reading this very full, rich, and thought-provoking book. Second, I want to make a little remarks to maybe complement some of what Devaki and Naoko has talked about on the feminist approach to economic policy, which is an aspect of this public policy dimension. And lastly, time permitting, I want to speak a little bit to some of the nuts and bolts issues that are important for effectively harvesting feminist knowledge in public spaces. Devaki talked a lot about think tanks, so I think I'll talk a little bit more about operational and other kinds of issues. So reflection on the book. It is quite a wonderful volume that captures the thinking of a wide group of feminist scholars, practitioners, advocates, crossing many different disciplines. Many of the authors, as professionals, also traverse the triple area of government / intergovernmental activities, academia, and civil society. Both Devaki and Naoko have spoken a little bit about the book, and I'll tell you from spending many days reading it and from past familiarity with the work of quite a number of the authors that it's a treasure trove of cutting-edge research and ideas that will resonate with you for a long time. So the book and its 14 essays is kind of an ingathering of inclusiveness and comprehensivity of the range and depth of feminist approaches to social policy, labor market, care/informal economy, measurement issues, but with significant empirical reference to the present historical conjuncture. The case studies in the book are quite interesting and compelling. They also present contrast in exploring the relationship between the state of economic development and the degree of uptake or uploading of gender equality and women's empowerment. I want to just flag two of these case studies because I think they're quite interesting, and one is particularly interesting to where I want to go with item two. And that's the case study in Japan and the case study on Cuba. So Professor Hiroko Hara, her chapter is on modernity, technology, and the progress of women in Japan, problems and prospects. And that work shows that while Japan has all the social and economic resources, It did not advance women equality as significantly as it could have, measured in terms of the gender empowerment measurement or the World Economic Forum gender gap. This is in contrast, in my estimation, to the case of Cuba, as well as if you take the case of Southeast Asia, you look at the Philippines that has one of the lowest GDP and the lower Human Development Index than, say, South Korea, than, say, Malaysia, than, say, Thailand, and yet has the highest, one of the highest level of gender and so forth. Therefore, it presents the case to me that gender equality and gender empowerment doesn't require for you to be a rich country to do that, because in both cases you see the dynamics. And if you read the case study by Martha Nunez Sarmiento, the case of Cuba and Cuban development alternatives and market-driven economy, a gender study on women's employment, it really most dramatically demonstrates that it is not necessary to be a rich country in order for women and society to advance. I think for me the Cuban case is particularly interesting because it's rather illustrates some of the points I want to make. And I just flag two things. In the case of Cuba, the fulcrum of policy of development is the idea that development is not simply synonymous, is not a synonym for economic growth, but rather it's to meet people's material and spiritual needs, as she says on page 268. So from the Cuban development perspective, progress is about economic transformation. It's about ensuring material well-being to all, and it should contribute to changing ideology and cultural patterns of inequality and discrimination. So progress in GDP growth and development is about changing the social relationship that conditions poverty. And so from the beginning, the economic approach of development was discarded, and the economy was organized in such a way as that GDP growth fed social policy, including universal education, health, social security, and so forth. What Munez called creating spaces of equality. And so to fast forward current period, your current high level of education, including at tertiary level of education, crossing the sciences, crossing scientific and technology and the administrative areas for women. Of course, there's much to be teased out about the extent to which we deal with either of these case studies dealt with issues of unpaid work and where women are in what we call the glass ceiling or jumping over the glass ceiling at the highest level. But my point, though, is that how you orient your economy and how you look at development is a significant precursor of how fast you'll get to changing the society and changing the mores. So from that, I'd like to go into my second strand, which is to actually make some remark about just what it is we're asking or seeking to harvest. What are the distinctiveness and the distinctions of feminist economics, and I'm not touching all the other kinds of public policy dimensions, social policy. I will restrict myself to feminist economics. I think it's very clear for all of us that the world is in steep crisis, multiplicity of crisis, and that these crises are evidence of systemic government, market, and institutional failure to combat and deal with very prominent issues, deregulation, rapid and uncontrolled accumulation, and growing inequality both within the North and within the South and between the North and the South. So one of the critical things is the collapse, or at least in 2008 it seemed that there was a collapse of the reign of market worship and the apparent weakening of at least three of the central pillars of globalization, market liberalization, trade liberalization, and financialization. And that the globalization juggernaut would seem to have slowed down, creating a space for the realignment of forces, institutions, and instruments of global policy and social power towards more socially and environmentally friendly goals. And when you read some of the papers, even currently now, you see lots of things that, in my estimation, kind of bring me back to deja vu, because when you read about layoffs and debt, it sort of brings you back to structural adjustment. And structural adjustment, and I'm like, we've been here before. It's memories of structural adjustment, Latin America and the Caribbean, and to some degree the U.S. under Ronald Reagan and U.K. under Thatcher. But it's actually describing Ireland, Spain, Greece, and many other countries that were at walk really far ahead in the development game. So that we're in a period of seemingly intractable global development crisis, and especially in the South. And this period, to me, calls for transformational leadership of women. Because it's not just a failure of the market and institution. It's a failure of leadership. And it's a failure of a particular type of leadership. And so, and as you can see with the various half-hearted attempts and the various failures of the crisis moving forward, we still, after 3 years, are talking about a weak economy, anemic recovery, feeble economy, and all of these adjectives. And you could see the stumbling around, the failure, that they keep reaching into the old toolbox of macroeconomic policy and coming out with the same set of tools, which are not going to be useful for solving this crisis. This crisis, in many respects, is a financially driven crisis, and financially driven crises have different characteristics from other kinds of crises. First of all, they're very long. They take over, they don't take the usual 4.5 to 5 year of a normal recession. They take up to 7 to 10 years, and I recommend you to read a book by Kenneth Rogoff and others of the IMF talking about the nature of this kind of financial driven crisis. So the leadership needs to also respond. So this is a period that actually speaks to the need for the transformational leadership of women for resolving development stalemate and ensuring equitable, gender-friendly, and sustainable development. And if you think there's no crisis of leadership, I give you the G20 meeting, I give you the European meeting that occurred last week, and I give you RIO+20. Okay? Serious crisis of leader. It's not going to get us out of the climate, finance, or food crisis. Not at this juncture. We're going to be, if we continue with this path, we'll be rumbling around this for quite some time. Okay, so unfortunately, during these crisis events, we're focusing on these very short-term targets framed in terms of transactional, reward, punishment, quid pro quo, win-lose approach to leadership. However, in the context of this kind of triple or even quadruple crisis, we need, this is an indictment also of that kind of transactional leadership. So we need more distinct kinds of leadership, and I think women have been demonstrating that in many public spaces all over the world. A leadership that has a compulsion to higher levels of motivation and morality in public, economic, and social decision-making, which also seeks to engender higher level of human conduct, ethical aspiration about the leader, the led, and so forth. So women's transformational leadership and ascendancy and the integration of gender analytical perspective, the kind of things that Devaki and Naoko have been talking about, in policy space of developing and developing countries, as well as within regional and global institutions, that seeks to manage development as a long-term process of social sustainability of the vein that the Cuban approach calls for, is kind of what we need for. We need it is an important bulwark for maintaining the forward progression of gender equality, women's and men's well-being, and women's overall empowerment. So women's transformational leadership approach to economic, public, social policy is focused on, among other things, bringing a set of gender-sensitive value into the public space. Thus, it presages the call for endowing macroeconomic, financial, and trade policy with a social content and with an emphasis on redistributive that builds the capacity and hence the functioning of the poor and the marginalized, even as it empowers their involvement in planning and decision-making. Another key element of women's management of and leadership that is critical to economic and in particular climate change is the intellectual point of departure / stimulation in terms of the emphasis on the household as a site of production and reproduction, advanced thinking and analysis about gender roles, gaps, biases, and their significance in economic performance, and embedding a social content to macroeconomic and financial policies. So we need a financial policy where financial institution actually serves the economy and not vice versa. So I'll skip my set of pages on what feminist political economy is and its relationship to heterodox economy. But I think we have a big hurdle to move, though I think we want to move it, because heterodox economics haven't actually been able to influence the policy space either, and which would have significantly changed a lot of the dynamics of where we were at a lot of the policies that heterodox and feminist economists proposed in 2008 actually been taken advantage of instead of the knee-jerk reaction back into the old toolbox that is totally useless and not serving us very well. So to round out, since I have 3 minutes left, I'd like to spend my last 3 minutes maybe talking a little bit about how you kind of operationalize some of these. I think for me, one of the exciting things in the book, was the concluding chapter by Patricia McFadden, who also was one of the early Dawn persons. And Patricia writes on page 293 that the moment we have arrived at, those of us who are consciously engaged in transforming our worlds and the larger spaces of human habitation, is one that is riddled with tremendous contradictions and threat to the security and future of mankind, whilst bearing at its core the unique possibilities for transformation that have accompanied such instances of change throughout the human narrative. And she also says that we are at a point, basically, where we're being asked as feminists, how do we impact this? Where do we go forward? How do we move the situation? So she writes that for us as feminists everywhere to regroup and take stock of our recent and political her story is up on us. As feminists in Africa, Latin America, the Caribbean, Asia, and Europe, we're beginning to ask new and difficult questions about where the feminist movement is, how it needs to be strengthened or rebuilt, and what direction and position feminists will have to adopt in order to reason and to respond in a more long-term ways to the phenomenon of capitalist globalization that has now gone awry. So this brings me nicely to this third section, which is about process, means, and mechanism. I think that one of the challenges in strengthening the present voice of feminists in public policy debate is the invisibility that Devati spoke to, but also the fragmentation of the approaches. There's not a strong sense that feminists have answers practically, have practical answers that are applicable to many issues, and yet they are. The most well-known practical thing that most people know feminists for are gender budgets. But actually, feminists have very practical, operational things to say about fiscal policy, about monetary policy, about trade policy, about all of the policies. But it's very fragmented and not cohesively brought together in any one place. And this book, I think, is a game changer, if you use Devaki's term, in that direction. At least here we have the beginning of that, and it's only the beginning. And the second thing I think we need is to bring the majority of women's group, who are still vested far too often simply in domestic violence, in the policy area, and food and health. And those are very important, don't get me wrong. But you cannot eradicate domestic violence and food insecurity without tackling the policy space, and in particular without tackling macroeconomic, trade policy, and financial policy, are seeing the interlink between them and how they promote and intensify and exacerbate the factors that create domestic violence, create food insecurity, in particular the financial crisis. Dramatic example of how finance-driven and a search for safer assets or more performing assets can lead to rising food prices. So I'm not saying don't do domestic violence. I'm saying that we have a job to critically see how the wider policies, how the environment of macroeconomics and finance and trade policy also impacts and exacerbate and create the situations that exacerbate and embolden domestic rights. So there's an interlinkage between these things and food and access to health care, including reproductive rights. So now I think it's really a time for not just the feminist economists to get together and think about where you want to go in light of the various isms and in light of the various policy prescriptions around Beijing, but also we need a strong process for strengthening parliamentarians, the gender machineries, the national gender machineries, and a gender advocate, so that they could seize the initiative to develop and implement the policy agenda that they have a process in building and working towards. So I think that we need to also bring them in the creation of the ideas and the directions that we need to go. So we need to sort of help to build, strengthen, but in a way also transform women's leadership awareness to looking and exploring and redefining finance, economic, trade, climate protection policy in a way that actually promotes and women's empowerment and gender equality, while at the same time building capacities for moving forward to even greater and bigger things. And I will leave that there. Thank you.
Well, I think that is an excellent note to move straight to discussion. Let me just make a couple of quick comments, and then I'm going to hand over to Christine to chair the discussion. I think
you know, have, working myself on China, it would be very interesting to see the example of Cuba, to what extent, when you liberalize the economy, you maintain the gains. The decollectivization, the loss of childcare and kindergartens and other kinds of care economy-related infrastructure tends to undermine very rapidly and reverse those gains, and that's experienced in China. But I think more importantly, this issue of leadership again comes out very strongly. One of the moments of Rio, I think, was a very high-level forum organized by UN Women, where all the women, I mean, impressive women leaders were gathered, and they included Gro Harlem Brundtland, Mary Robinson, Taya Halonen, etc. So where you see real leadership. And yet, because of the nature of the discussions around Rio, the main focus was actually the restating of the need for reproductive rights that had been pushed out of the Rio agenda and instead replaced by reproductive health again. And of course, these are critical issues, but are they the issues that in that forum should have been really the focus of those, that kind of women's leadership? And I think we're pointing to other directions. We need somehow to integrate these movements, but to recognize the broader challenges and strategic agendas we need to take up. So on that note, I will hand over to Christine.
Check out our other podcasts available free on the iTunes Store. For more information, go to our website, www.unris.org. If you have any suggestions for future podcasts, email us at press@unris.org. Thank you for listening.